It's the latest in a long line of books by former Labor politicians, but this one is different. For a start, it was written decades before Labor's latest round of leadership woes, and the names Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard are nowhere to be seen. It's perhaps one more for the students of political history interested in the blow-by-blow of the inner sanctum of what Gareth Evans describes as the gold standard government of the Hawke-Keating years. Gareth Evans is best remembered as Australia's foreign minister, but before that he was Attorney General and then Minister of Resources and Energy in the Hawke cabinet. And it was during this period that he too wrote a diary. The result is a new book called Inside the Hawke-Keating Government, A Cabinet Diary. Gareth Evans joins us from our Melbourne studios. Gareth Evans, welcome back to RN Breakfast.
Good morning, Fran. Nice to talk to you. It has been a while.
It has been a while. And this is really an insider's account of the workings of government. Sometimes, if I may say with great respect, down to some very mundane detail, but otherwise very colourful. Why did you decide that this was a story worth telling now, so long after the Hawke-Keating years?
Mainly because when I came back from overseas 10 years away, I discovered to my surprise just how many people were interested in the Hawke-Keating government, and drawing comparisons between our perceived success and what was going wrong with various successes. And I thought, well, maybe this stuff, as ancient as it was, did have a certain degree of interest in demonstrating how, even with manifestly clashing egos and ambitions and vanities, the sort of thing that's really, I suppose, endemic in every government, nonetheless, we were able to pretty successfully surmount all that and produce a chain of very constructive delivery results over a very long period.
I'll come to that reform program in a moment, and also some of those challenging egos and vanities. But the book really, when you read it all, you get another sense again, if you need any reminding, of how demanding the job of a cabinet minister is, meeting after meeting. But it struck me reading it now that the absence of a 24-hour news cycle meant, for a start, you sometimes got a family Sunday in, not always, but sometimes. And if you're overseas, incredibly, sometimes you had to wait to get on the Qantas flight home to learn the news. It was a simpler time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that, and one has to temper any criticism of subsequent governments with that realisation of how impossible you guys have made it for those in government because of that obsession with getting your story out every single hour of every single day.
I think that cuts both ways, Gareth.
Well, it does. I mean, governments don't have to succumb on quite the scale that they have been, and I think that lesson has been learnt fairly dramatically over the last few years, and I think in the future we'll find people realising that what matters is cutting through with decent explanations of what you're about, having a clear storyline, a clearly articulated philosophy. And I think those things are survivable and are deliverable in the contemporary age, but they will need a recognition by governments that that's a problem.
Just to stick with this cabinet for a moment, this government, because it's widely regarded as one of the best cabinets Australia's ever had. But these diaries, and we're only talking a couple of years into the government, a year and a half, I think, you start, they reveal a cabinet full of, as you say, jealousies, competition, sometimes even disdain for some colleagues, and early frustration with the Prime Minister, Bob Hawke. How much disquiet was there from the start?
Oh, not a lot. I mean, it was just part of the rough and tumble. And because you're recording stuff as it's happening and every passing little sandstorm, you know, does get sort of blown up just because of the very nature of diary writing, maybe it seems more dramatic in retrospect than it was at the time. It all just seemed part of the rough and tumble. But the important thing to say about that government was that notwithstanding, you know, all those dynamics at work, it was an environment in which everything was contestable, everything was contested. And where sort of argument prevailed over the exercise of authority. So the leadership was strong, but the leadership was never able to, you know, have captain's picks and captain's calls in a way that were accepted with grumbling distaste by, you know, the rest of the cabinet.
Was that Hawke's greatest capacity, do you think, to allow that?
Yeah, well, it was Keating's too. I mean, both of them recognised the worth of cabinet government, even though on occasions they found it very difficult to deal with cantankerous colleagues who weren't prepared just to go quietly along for the dictated ride. And that's really, I think, an important distinction with the way that you know, politics seems to have been working subsequently. And it's one thing that I think does come out very clearly, along with other characteristics of that government, which was a real willingness to consult, to listen and to explain, to get out there and, you know, to treat a focus group negative line as being just the beginning of the argument rather than the end of it. And, yeah, sure, it's more difficult to communicate, to educate in this contemporary environment than it was then, but I'm not sure that people have been trying as hard as they could have and should have.
I tell you what does come out too, and this is early on, as I say, the Hawke government was elected in 83. By mid-85, or late 85, the Hawke-Keating tensions are very evident. You describe one, as you say, very vitriolic scene between Hawke and Keating where you observe, it's the clearest indication I've seen for some time as to how bad things are fundamentally between them. Was leadership tension already a factor at this early stage?
Yeah, it was hovering around, but it was absolutely containable, and it was no more, I think, in retrospect, than the, you know, the rough and tumble of politics generally. What makes it more sort of public is the fact that 30 years after the event, I'm actually, you know, recording conversations that were held. But these are conversations that are held in the margins of every government at every stage of its evolution.
Even at this early stage of government.
Yeah, what matters is how well you contain it and deal with it. And remember that this partnership continued very successfully for another 5 years after the 2 years that I write about. And, you know, that was the reality. I mean, as Keating said to me, you know, as I record later in the book, I mean, both he and I may have felt that we'd been, you know, to be vulgar about it, had been screwed over by Hawke so many times that the first fine careless rapture had long since evaporated. Nonetheless, we were all committed to the marriage. And that's the distinctive thing about it. I mean, the politics, including the internal politics, almost never drowned the commitment to good policy.
You're listening to RM Breakfast. It's 21 minutes to 9. Our guest is Gareth Evans, who's published a diary he wrote during a couple of years of the Hawke government. It's called Inside the Hawke-Keating Government, a cabinet diary. As we've been discussing, the Hawke government is still held up these days as a strong reforming government, and times were different. Some say, well, there was much more low-hanging fruit for a government to fix at that time, floating the dollar, cutting the tariffs, getting the unions together in some kind of prices and income accord. And also importantly, you didn't face a hostile Senate back then in the same way, in a completely negative opposition as we have now. Would you agree that reform was easier back then?
Well, people talk about the bipartisanship that existed, but really that only existed when we were playing with our sort of dry economic agenda into things that were really foundational principles for the other side of politics. When it came to, you know, some of the really hard stuff, I mean, the Mabo thing, for example, you know, don't tell me about bipartisanship there, because I had a 50-hour debate with the opposition in the Senate opposing that native title legislation every inch of the way. And similarly, on a lot of the economic reforms that I described, to the trade practices legislation, cash bidding and the mining sector, all of these things were fiercely contested. And we did have our problems in the Senate. And we had our own particular wackos then in the West Australian Greens. I mean, they weren't quite as completely irresponsible as what we're witnessing now from those holding the balance of power. But don't let it be thought that it was an easy environment in which to operate. And the reforms that we did, after all, had been on the, you know, the commentators' agendas for years, but had never been delivered by any previous government, and there were deeply hostile constituencies out there. It did take leadership, and it did take a degree of courage and commitment to get this stuff through.
And I did note, it was almost in passing, but I caught it, that you saved at one point the Human Rights Commission from being dropped during a pre-budget negotiation.
Well, I didn't save much else in the human rights agenda. That was a pretty frustrating period. This was a very economically oriented government. It wasn't much into the Whitlamite, sort of constitutional legal reform stuff that I was so passionate about in those early days. But that's life, you move on.
Gareth Evans, can we move on to now? And you spent many years as Australia's foreign minister, and then many years after that at the International Crisis Centre. I think you are one of the doctrines of the responsibility to protect doctrine. If we look at what's going on with Iraq now, I know you've written an article on this issue in the past where you examined if there's any justification for renewed Western or other external military intervention in Iraq. In your view, has the situation with Islamic State now, the sheer brutality of their approach, does that provide justification for external intervention, in your view, right now?
Yeah. It may well do. It certainly did a couple of weeks ago with the Yazidis caught up in the mountain with a massacre feared. There's another village with a massacre feared, you know, right now. And I think, you know, sort of a military intervention under those circumstances can be justified, provided you satisfy a whole bunch of prudential criteria about actually being sure that you'll do more good than harm. I'm much less enthusiastic about some more generalized military intervention to try and deal with the general problem of Sunni extremism and to try and prop up what's been so far an extremely dysfunctional government in Baghdad. I do think under those circumstances we have to learn the lessons of history that military interventions can be terribly counterproductive in terms of generating hostility to the West by the Islamic world generally.
Mm. And well, it's very fraught right now. I mean, you know, we know our Prime Minister is examining this right now.
Sure, and I think, you know, you've got to work out the utility of airstrikes in this sort of situation, because that invariably causes civilian casualties. These things can never be surgical. So it's a very close call, but I notice that Tony Abbott is talking about any possible Australian military involvement being in a humanitarian context, which I take to be in the exercise of the internationally accepted responsibility to protect people at risk of genocide and mass atrocity crimes. So I think in that narrow context, it's certainly plausible, reasonable, sensible to be talking about a military option, just as we should have been talking about a military option internationally against the Khmer Rouge in the 1970s and against the terrible things that happened in Rwanda in the 1990s. You don't have to be a general enthusiast for sending in the Marines to recognise there are exceptional circumstances where common humanity simply demands that extreme response.
Gareth Evans, thank you very much for joining us on Breakfast.
Thank you, Fran. Nice to talk to you.
Gareth Evans, and his book is A Cabinet Diary, Inside the Hawke-Keating Government. It's published by Melbourne University Press, and a constant theme throughout the diary is really a poignant story, I think, too, is Gareth Evans' concern for Lionel Murphy, and the diary, in fact, the last day he writes the diary is the day of Lionel Murphy's death.